Tā, kia ora, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. Ko Elizabeth Collins, aho. So I just had a little greeting in Māori, and just saying hello all, and maybe I said welcome all, I don't know, and that my name is Elizabeth Collins. So welcome to New Zealand Vegan Podcast, episode 129, and I'm your host Elizabeth Collins, and this episode I'm just going to talk about it's basically nothing new. It's the sort of misrepresentation of abolitionist advocacy by, well, of abolitionist and the abolitionist theory and abolitionist advocacy by the welfarist movement, mostly these people who are paid careerists. They must be getting really desperate now, because they've just put out another study, which is, it's supposed to be a statistical study, and there's all this data, and they've done this survey and everything. The survey itself and the statistics itself, there are people who are like into that stuff who are analyzing it and debunking it as we speak, but it's, I'm not even going to worry about that, because it's pretty pathetic, really. And I mean, I don't know enough about statistics, but the reason why I'm responding to this is because it just really, what really gets me is the apparent dishonesty. I want to make a disclaimer, because I'm trying not to stoop to the level of people who do character assassinations, which is what we have to deal with, and I don't want to be that. So when I say dishonest, maybe it's not deliberately dishonest, okay? I did say that on my Facebook page, that it's unconscionably dishonest, deliberately dishonest. That was my immediate reaction. That's always my reaction when they blatantly misrepresent abolition the way that they do. But let's just say it's misrepresentational and it's ignorant, not using that as an ad hominem, using that as a descriptor, like as uninformed. So if I say dishonest, that's me being, you know, jumping to a conclusion, and, you know, I'll try not to jump to that conclusion. I'll try not to use that word. Okay, so what happened is there's this new study, and it talks about they very quick to label abolitionists, they put it in quotes because they don't want that to be a positive thing. I don't know why they put it in quotes, because abolitionist and abolition is very, very real. I mean, we don't put welfarist in quotes because it's very real. But anyway, they call it purity messaging. So they talk about animal cruelty messaging versus purity messaging. And the purity messaging, they put in brackets, quote, abolitionist, right? These are welfarists who are very, very dedicated. And they, like I said, they must be getting really even more desperate. So this is a good sign. I mean, obviously, abolition, they can't ignore us anymore. It's making waves. The movement's growing. More and more people are turning on to it. So we have to expect these things. I mean, this is the kind of thing you expect. Same thing from the animal agriculture industries. They're always going to have, you know, there's always going to be a reaction to any kind of movement once it starts taking on. And the thing about the abolitionist ideas, I mean, forget everything else, they are ideas, they're concepts, and they are so powerful. They are unstoppable. They just are, and I'm not surprised by anything that's happening. I can't predict the rate that things are going to happen. I think things are happening exponentially, and there's a very nice change. It's excruciatingly slow in the grand scheme of things for my taste, but it's been pretty amazing. And I'm not surprised, because, you know, these ideas are, that's what they are. So before I talk about the misrepresentation, whether deliberate or not, of us in this article, and the sort of bias, the sort of deliberate bias that they use, I just want to bring you to their conclusion first of all. So they say, the last thing that they write in this article is, animal advocates who wish to create the most diet change and thereby spare the most animals should focus on the suffering of farm animals and possibly the environmental and health impacts of meat consumption. They should avoid focusing on the rights of animals or how one needs to be vegan to have moral consistency. Just let that sink in. This is what they're telling people. okay? There is probably nothing more speciesist than that statement right there. The reason why I'm even wasting my time with this is because I do know that there are new vegans who are going to be taken in by this, because a lot of new vegans are really speciesist still. I was. And it's so entrenched. It's such a huge part of who we are, speciesism, that, as we know, vegans are very speciesist. And they will be taken in by this for a lot of reasons. And this is why I do want to put this podcast out there, even though I really think the study is quite laughable. I mean, in a lot of ways. But I'll just focus on the couple of things that I really wanted to focus on, which really, really irritate me. First of all, they really irritate me. This is so personal. No, I'm just kidding. It's okay. Sorry. It's my podcast and I'll complain if I want to. So they created this survey and they made up three flyers, and then they did one flyer which was focused on cruelty, and then one focus which they talked about the rights of animals and moral consistency, which they caused the, quote, abolitionist, based on text from the BVA. And then the third flyer focused on the environmental impact. They made their own flyer. They didn't use an actual abolitionist flyer. They made their own little, very selectively worded, completely misrepresentational flyer. When we're giving out flyers to people, like advocacy, I mean, there's tactics, right? So when you give out a flyer, you have as much information in there as possible. When you're just giving something to someone to read and you're not there to discuss it with them, or you think they're just going to pick it up from a they're going to pick it up from like a library or something, you do want that is, you know, you do have you're tactical about what you write in there, because you're not going to get a chance to discuss it with them. So you do keep it simple and you don't want to overload them. But, you know, they didn't use a real abolitionist flyer, or, you know, which is what very telling, isn't it? They're too scared to use the real thing. So they did this survey, and then they used this flyer that they made. These are people who completely misunderstand abolition and have no idea how to advocate for it, sadly. And then according to their survey, the cruelty flyer is the one that had the most effect on changing people's diets. Now, like I said, I'm not going into the statistics, but first of all, changing your diet, that means nothing. What does that even mean? According to these people, this is the end of their flyer that they said was so effective. They said, they talked about cruelty. Chickens live their lives in dark cages, and male chicks cannot lay eggs. They're killed. Egg-laying hens are packed into cages so small. Pigs are crammed into pens, and they talk about those things. Then they say, you can help end this cruelty by cutting out or cutting back on meat and other animal products. Just by replacing meat with tasty meat-free meals, you can spare animals from a lifetime of suffering. So, this is the last paragraph of their flyer, the one that they said was the most effective. So putting aside the ridiculous, quote, abolitionist flyer that they created, what I want to say about this kind of thing is that, look, we live in a world in which speciesism is as embedded as sexism, okay? It's pretty major, because once you wake up to patriarchy, it's like going vegan. You just cannot get away from it. It's just everywhere, unbelievably so. Same with when you wake up to white privilege and racism, the structural of it. It's just so saturated. Everything's so saturated. So first of all, they don't. When you live in a world like that, and you've got, and you know, you're not challenging you're not challenging the embedded ideas. You're just kowtowing to speciesism, and you're just coddling the speciesism the way this flyer is, and giving people. I mean, I'll never forget when I was at my stall years ago, and there was a woman there who was not. She was vegan, but she wasn't. She was passing through, and then somebody else came along, and I was talking to them about veganism, and they were. He was kind of showing off to his girlfriend, and he was. He was just saying whatever. He was just laughing about it. And then she said to them, well, you can cut down this is what this woman said. I was so upset. And then they said, oh, well, I can do that. Well, yeah, you can do that. I mean, it's super easy. I mean, you can kowtow to any kind of prejudice and not challenge anybody and get a response. The thing that really, 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 really bothers me about this, not just their total misrepresentation, I mean, their ignorance about abolitionist advocacy, first of all. If you look at the abolitionist flyer, see their conclusion, like remember their conclusion, right? I mean, anybody with half a brain who even remotely pays attention to anything abolitionists do already know this is just so stupid. But they said their conclusion, which I'll read again, where they said, if you want to create diet change, which again, what are we talking about? I mean, what are they like? Diet change could mean just like having a meat-free Monday. Do you know what I'm saying? I'll get to that later anyway. So, and they say they should focus on the suffering and possibly the environmental and health impacts. They should avoid focusing on the rights or how one needs to be vegan. This is a conclusion. Well, if you look at the abolitionist pamphlet, if you look at the BVA pamphlet, which they took their supposed, you know, source from, they mention suffering and they mention what the animals go through and they mention the environmental impacts. They put it all together under this, we have a moral obligation to go vegan. They conveniently sort of seem to forget that. So it's completely misrepresentational of the literature and the advocacy that we do. But what really, really, really upsets me about it is because it's just this, it's so insidious. It's just so insidious because what they're doing is it reinforces speciesism in advocates and in vegans, because the bottom line is, you know, of course people respond much more agreeably when you don't challenge them or they don't actually have to do anything. Cutting down a couple of meals, that is not making any kind of commitment to change. And it's not challenging the status quo. In order to make change, you have to challenge the status quo or nothing will change. So when you go along, like one of the things why I get so sort of sad about this, it's so heartbreaking, is their poverty of ambition. It's what they will settle for. You know, when I see a bunch of non-vegans cheering on a welfareist page, I'm like, there's a problem. The thing that these people want is affirmation. They want merit badges from the non-vegan public. And when somebody says to you, oh yeah, I'm going to change based on, because you've basically told me I don't have to hardly do anything, I can do that, you know, and you mean even like, they're not even thinking, but like, look at the difference. Like even their statistics, which they claim are so damaging, they say that, I mean, I don't know how they got to this. Okay. They said that the animal cruelty flyer, the one I read you that says at the end, cut down and then just completely focuses on meat, like entirely on meat. They say that the flyer's impact, when translated into the number of days of farm animal suffering, I'm not going to go into how they got to that. They said 350 days of suffering from that flyer. The environmental flyer, they said 310 days of suffering. And then the abolitionist flyer, they said 241 days of suffering. Well, when you're talking about somebody who's influenced by an abolitionist flyer, I mean, what's the difference between somebody who you say you can just have a meat-free meal every now and then, or, you know, you can go vegan. 241 days of being vegan translating into a lifetime of being vegan. I'm actually quite impressed, given that the abolitionist movement is so new, given that we've had nothing but speciesist welfareist campaigning that kowtows to speciesism and totally coddles non-veganism. And that has been very, very ongoing and is still the dominant paradigm. And is this, and we still, you know, whatever their calculations, I mean, that enough to me is actually a sign that, you know, it is. They say abolitionist advocacy doesn't work at all. They say people turn and run away from it completely. So even if you want to take in this ridiculous, whatever statistics they got for these numbers, and I've had some people who are quite onto it, who sort of know about these things, have made some comments about their, because they published the study of this to get these statistics. But you know what I'm saying? So like, we live in a world, so now we've got this, we've even got this evidence from these people who are, you know, desperately trying to convince people not to promote veganism because it doesn't suit their agenda for people to promote veganism. These are animal rights advocates, that's what they call themselves. And we're already showing the impact that abolition has, even after such a short time. It's such a new concept in terms of consistent advocacy done by a growing movement of people that just hasn't happened before. It started to happen in the very, very, very beginning for a very little while when Gary Francione was first got involved. I think Tom Reagan's, you know, book had that impact on people focusing on the moral rights, but then it just died down very quickly and welfareism just took over. Then you have Gary Francione come out with his books and his website and then his ideas, and finally they're getting hold. And so the thing that just really, really makes me so sad is, like, people will settle for that. People will settle for that. And it's non-specific, because I don't know, 350 days, none of that. I'm not going to get into the statistics. So number one, you've got this evidence, even if you want to believe their calculations or whatever, that shows that even in the climate of just overwhelming welfareism, we have people turning on to abolition, and it's a new concept. So imagine if instead of these people completely selling out the animals and giving the public two options. One, you can come along with us and all you got to do is cut down a little bit, have some meat-free meals, and we're going to give you a great big pat on the back, and we're going to tell you, you saved 350 days of suffering, whatever that means, however you get that figure. And then they point to us and say, they're the purists. Over there, there's the purity people. They're total extremists, you know, whatever. And these are your two options. And then they get, you know, then they get all proud when they have a bunch of non-vegans who don't want to be challenged and don't want to have to face up to the reality of their actions, saying, well, gee, I'm just going to take the meat-free option, you know. You know what I'm saying, right? You're listening to me, you know what I'm saying, right? So it just sort of reinforces to me even more that we're actually way better than we even thought. I mean, honestly, I mean, when I go out doing my stall, there is heaps more people turning onto veganism and turning onto the abolitionist, you know, message. So the really sad thing about this is that it is tempting for new vegans who are very, very speciesist and who are, you know, it is a way less work and way less effort to go out and completely kowtow to speciesism and completely coddle non-veganism and stroke people's egos and not challenge them on the fundamental morality of their actions. And why am I not surprised that they're, you know, people are more amenable to it? Doesn't that should be troubling them? That should be scaring the heck out of them. They, as animal rights advocates, should be they're trumpeting it as if it's some sort of victory. So so it's really sad. And so in terms of vegan advocates, like, I'll talk a bit about some other advocacy as well that I've been meaning to do a podcast for a while. So that's sort of my, I mean, I don't know if I sort of pointed out this. I mean, it's really a ridiculous blog article that they've done. I hope that somebody can break down statistics. I'm not interested, but I'm not even interested in that. I'm just saying, like, if only they, and I don't think these people who wrote this blog, I mean, I think they make money off. I could be wrong, and I don't, you know, like I said, I'm not trying to, I don't know if they make money off of advocacy for animals. I don't know. They certainly are determined to continue to tell people, and I quote, that people should avoid focusing on the rights of animals or how one needs to be vegan to have moral consistency. That's their words. These are supposedly animal people, right? Very, very sad. And then you take a new vegan who's just become vegan, or who's and they're new to advocacy. If they're like any other new vegans, like I was, they're desperate to do something, because the thing about veganism that's different from when you encounter racism and when you encounter sexism, or sorry, when you wake up to when you wake up to white privilege and when you wake up to patriarchy, whether you're a man, woman, whether you're white, black, whatever, when you wake up to what it actually means, the thing about veganism is that it's actually the vast majority of the population doing actual physical hands-on speciesist that actually literally is causing death. So white privilege is extremely damaging, and it's hugely structural. And then as a white person who is woken up to the existence of white privilege, I am aware of it now, and I want to break it down. I want to abolish it. I want to break down the systems. I do what I'm learning from other people how to do that. I'm listening to people of color who are saying, this is what, you know, if you really want to do something, this is what you do. You be aware of it and stuff like that. And that's great. I mean, I'm not actively oppressing, like I am not a member of the KKK going out and lynching people. Okay. But when you talk about non-veganism, you basically, that's what you know what I'm saying? In terms of the actions, you're actually part of something that serious, and you can actually stop doing that. So while you can't do, like while you sort of, it's a bit overwhelming to think, okay, how do we break down these structures? How do we break down these social, social like constructs that are in place and all those kinds of things? But when it comes to, and same with patriarchy, like, oh, I want patriarchy to die. I just want patriarchy to die. Like I want to abolish it. So I don't, promote pornography. I don't, but I never did, you know. I'm learning all the other subtleties, but you know, in order for patriarchy to die, men have to stop raping. Men have to stop oppressing women. And that's that. So when it comes to veganism, the difference between when you wake up to veganism is you can actually remove, like I wrote in one of my abolitionist, literatures, which these people completely steered clear of because it would just completely blow their little survey to bits. But I talk about how you can actually remove an enormous amount of direct participation and an enormous amount of violence that you are personally involved in as a non-vegan from your life by going vegan. And when you go vegan and you realize that, you look around you and you're like, oh my God, we could eliminate, not just reduce, but eliminate so much torture and suffering and death. All you've got to do is go vegan. That's not the end of it, because it's a structural system. There's speciesism, there's hunting, which is, you know, there's going to be people who are out there who's going to want to continue to exploit animals or whatever, whatever. And then, you know, we'll be in the same position as we are. You know, I mean, there is overt racism and there's overt sexism and then there's the underpinnings. Well, right now what we're dealing with veganism is the same as what they were dealing with in the time of human race-based slavery, and that that is actually happening, and you have to stop having slaves, you know, first of all. So when vegans realize this, they are like, oh my God, we can make such a difference. We have to do something about this. Like my mother and my brother and my father can go vegan today. I mean, this is just incredible. And they're so desperate to do something, but they're still very, very speciesist. And also they might be new and they don't really have, they've never challenged people fundamentally on their actions. And it takes, you know, a certain amount of backbone, but not that much, because when you consider the consequences, first of all, like unlike people who were against slavery or even against racism, you're not going to get lynched or tarred and feathered, okay, by talking to people about veganism, because this is what we advocate. We advocate vegan education. We don't advocate getting violent to people. We don't advocate screaming at people. This is all these misrepresentations that the welfarists do, but which thankfully they didn't do in this. They're wising up now. They can't get away with it forever because people are not that stupid. But they see through all the sort of blatant sort of misrepresentation. But yeah, so this, that's the really sad thing. And then what happens is you take those new vegans it's insidious, but it's kind of like it's just less work. I mean, it doesn't take as much work to go out and say to people, oh, you know, chickens are in cages, just only eat cage-free eggs, or just only eat less eggs. Can you just eat less eggs? And then people will say, yeah, I can do that. There's a big difference between that and going out and saying, you know, the reality is that any egg you eat is a direct cause of this injustice. And that's the reality of the situation. So if you care at all about cutting down on the eggs, why do you want to cut down? Because of the suffering? Well, why not just eliminate it? But people do react defensively to that. That's what social movements are all about. People, you have to fight, you know, you have to, it's a struggle. So they're giving people this sort of easy way out, this sort of, this wishy-washy and they're selling it to them, and people are taking it because then, and then they can point to the figures and say, well, I'm saving 350 days. And whatever, you know, like I said, I'm whatever that means, I mean, wherever they got that figure from. So it's very, very damaging and insidious. And so they're basically kowtowing to sort of, you know, gosh, I can't think of the words that I want to use. All my English language has gone out of my head, but they're basically feeding into that when it comes to new advocates who, instead of as a movement, as one movement, bolstering each other up non-violently and creatively to be able to have the courage, background, or just whatever you want to call it, to go out and face those difficult conversations with people where you are challenging them. And right off the bat, they are going to get defensive. But because the ideas are so profound and true, and because people really do care, but people take time to change. This is another misrepresentation about us. There's just so much wrong with this. It's just so unfair to the non-human animals for them to do this. And they're getting away with it because it's like I said, you know, for a new vegan who might be a little timid or whatever the case may be, you know, they're going to go out and get a bunch of, you know, smiles and happy. So, yes, I agree with you. I'm going to change my diet, whatever that means. I'm going to have a meat-free meal a week or whatever. And then they're going to say, oh, I saved all these animals. And what's happening is that they're absolutely reinforcing speciesism, making things worse. And they're ignoring the fact that even against all the odds, even against this career welfarist movement of paid professionals, okay, desperate to save their jobs, there's still a huge response to abolition, even according to their completely biased and ridiculous survey. I mean, oh my gosh. So yeah, this is nothing new in terms of a reaction and stuff, but it's a little more sort of blatant than the rest. But it is the thing that why I'm responding, why I'm hoping that there's new vegans listening to this is, listen, you know, we are creating a movement of people who are helping each other to learn how to challenge speciesism and, yes, stand up for the rights of animals, not avoid focusing on the rights of animals. And talking about how one needs to be vegan to have moral consistency, because it's true. We want to create that movement. So either you're going to join us or you're going to, you know, get sort of sucked in by this sort of complacency here, where you can judge your success based on how easy it is for you to get a thumbs up from somebody who's continuing to exploit animals. You know what I'm saying? And look at the data. Look at it from my point of view as somebody who's, you know, when I first became a vegan, there was no abolitionist movement to speak of. There was a movement. I mean, I think one person is a movement. Gary Francione and Anna Charlton, they were the abolitionist movement. There was a few other people who were there. There was the Vegan Freaks podcast. So I shouldn't say that, but it was certainly not what it's compared to now. And again, like when you put those ideas out there, you actually can't control. Like once the idea's out there, you can't control what people are doing with them. So there's lots of people out there who are confusing the ideas, who are they're obfuscating them, they're getting them sort of wrong, you know, they're deliberately misrepresenting them in some places, or they're just ignorantly misrepresenting them, they're just uninformed. You can't really do anything about that once you put the ideas out there, including the idea of veganism, because I talked to somebody at my store for veganism, and I try really, really, really hard to sort of say, watch out for all of the frauds, watch out for the fraudsters, watch out for the fraudulent representations out there. Keep your mind, now you've heard it, doesn't this make sense? And they say, yeah, this makes sense. But then I can't, when they go back on home on the internet and they start reading stuff like this, you know what I mean? I can't really control that. I can only just hope, you know, that I have set a baseline. But can you imagine if, as a movement, we all creatively and non-violently focused on abolition? And what's really sick is that, another thing that's really sick about this survey is that their claim is that you focus on the cruelty and you tell people to cut down or whatever, and you don't talk to them about veganism, you avoid it. And they talk possibly about the environmental health impacts. What abolitionist advocacy does is we actually do include all of that. We include the suffering. We just don't lie and say that, you know, cage-free eggs are a huge improvement or whatever the case may be, you know, but it's in there. And also we talk about the environment. And so imagine if, you know, like the way that they wrote our pamphlet, this, well, what they called our pamphlet, the information that they took out of the BVA for this, again, I don't want to say these people are deliberately dishonest, but this seems to be what they do think that abolitionists, they actually have no idea what abolitionist advocacy is because they're not actually doing it. You know, so they don't, you know, they just don't know what it is. It's not a robotic, sort of out of context, you know, statements that have no follow up, you know, and no broader ideas, you know. So yeah, so that's why I'm responding to this, because I'm just really hoping that people will just see the terrible poverty ambition, the terrible speciesism, even putting aside the misrepresentation of abolition, just how sad this is. Because, like I said, when you want to change the world for real, you, in the beginning, you are going to have to challenge the status quo. And in the very beginning, you might get a lot more pushback. And so you might do a survey and say, well, I told, you know, I talked to 10 people about veganism. Like, let's say 10 years ago, you talked to 10 people about veganism, and two of them were like, well, I might maybe cut down. And then eight of them were like, you're totally crazy. Compare that to now. So let's look at the long term. Why are we not looking at permanently changing the world? Why are we not looking at that? I refuse to even give one more second of time to this speciesist poverty of ambition. It's too sad. It makes me depressed, but that's my response to it. I just hope that, you know, people can sort of see that. And I feel very, very, very sorry for people who are this dedicated to that. It makes me very, very sad for them. Okay, so that's my response. All right, so then I wanted to talk a little bit about this. This sort of leads into something else as well, where I was, because like I said, the ideas out there, of the abolitionist ideas, and they're being co-opted and they're being distorted and blah, 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 blah. And like I said, nothing you can do about that. That's why I always just stick to the source. Just read Gary Francione's books, listen to his speeches, his interviews that he's done, read his books. And listen to the debate with Eric Marcus. Please listen to that debate. If you listen to that debate and you don't know where you stand, then I cannot help you. I'm not saying you're going to listen to that debate and not be a welfareist. You might listen to that debate and be like, yeah, I'm totally with Eric Marcus. Fine. At least you know, you've heard the actual from Gary Francione's mouth, not some stupid misrepresentation, distortion of it from some, you know, welfareist who's got an agenda, you know? So go and listen to the debate. Read the debates that he did with Bruce Friedrich, where, you know what I mean? You know, just at very least, you know, do that, do us a favor or whatever. Okay, so what I was going to talk about just briefly now that I've gotten that out of my system, of course I feel a lot better, is that there's new things happening in New Zealand. I've just discovered bite marks in one of my computer things. I wonder who that could be, Miss Shebby. Anyway, so I've noticed that there was a recent event in New Zealand where they were doing what was called witnessing, I think it was, where they were standing by the side of the road and holding up signs saying, we see you, we're sorry. These are words on a sign. They were holding them up as trucks driving cows and sheep and, you know, trucks driving either to the slaughterhouse or to some other horrible situation. Eventually they're all, yeah. And they were standing there holding these signs, and this was their activism. And then you've got, of course, the DXE who just chant in a restaurant, scream, you know, like yell. They just stand in a restaurant and yell. Need I say, I completely disagree with that. Have I even talked about, there was a lot of stuff about DXE, which is called a group called Direct Action Everywhere. There's so much, yeah, but they're another one who, I mean, they would love this. You know, they can go in Chipotle and say, cut down, you know, and then they can all be in bed together with these people who wrote this article, because the DXE also say you shouldn't talk about veganism. But the thing that gets me about that, when I really compare it to what we try to do and sort of the advocacy that I'm trying to do, and even though I know that for some people, see, one of the going back to this article and going back to when you have a face-to-face conversation with somebody where you are actually challenging their morality, that can be daunting to somebody when you think about it. Now, the more you do it, you learn how to do it in a way in which you don't end up getting punched or yelled at by them. I've never been punched at my stall. I've had somebody get angry and defensive a couple of times, but online is a whole different story. I mean, where there's so many trolls and all those kinds of things. But then again, you know, you have to develop a thick skin. At least they can't, you know, attack you, you know, physically, right? So what I find, again, I don't want to judge people in terms of, I don't know them. These are all strangers. Like all of these people I'm talking about, I don't know these people. I don't know the people who wrote this blog that I'm reading, the one I quoted where the, you know, did the survey. I don't know anybody from DXE. I don't know any of the people who did this vigil or whatever witnessing in New Zealand where they were standing by the side. I don't know. But I personally, my observation is that it is actually a lot less work, you know, challenging in terms of for the advocates, even though it might not seem that way, to stand on a street corner and have a sign pointing at a truck full of animals who cannot read your sign. And I know they know that. I know that these people know that. The sign is for the benefit of other people. But how many conversations are they having? You know, they're standing there making a statement, and it is very sad. You know, the animals, when you see them in the trucks, there's nothing to really compare. You know, I mean, yeah, there is if you live in a place where there's maybe Syrian refugee crisis, and you see those kinds of things around you. So it's a very traumatic event for every, you know, for anybody who's paying attention. Most of the passersby weren't paying attention, so these people were trying to get the passersby to pay attention by emotion, you know, being emotional and stuff like that. And I know the intentions were good, but my question is, how many people did you actually talk to about their involvement in that? And my guess is none, because that was a bit of like another spectacle. You may just, you know, and then same with the DXE, they get to go in there and they yell. But how many people do they actually talk to? I mean, I don't think it's very many. So like, even though like on the surface, it seems to me, and maybe I'm being very biased myself, being very, biased, I guess, because to me, going into a restaurant and yelling is mortifying. Like I would just never do that. To me, that's just not something I would be at all comfortable doing. I'm much more comfortable having a table where people, we talk, okay? So maybe these people are much more comfortable yelling to the walls of the restaurant, hoping that the people sitting in there can hear them yelling, than they are talking to somebody over a table. I don't know, but I would, to me, it's like if you have got sort of the, I guess, audacity to go into a restaurant where people are just not expecting you to be there. Like when I have my stall, it's all very transparent. I'm very transparent about what I'm doing. There's no surprises at all at my stall. And that's deliberate. So when people come over, they know they're going to be advocated to. They know it's going to be about veganism and animal rights because that's all that my site, you know. Whereas in you imagine you're sitting in a restaurant and all of a sudden people come in and start yelling. So I think it is audacious, right? And I'm just saying that as to use the dictionary meaning of the word. I don't agree with it for lots and lots of reasons, which I'm not going to go into. But to be able to do that, and then to think that you know, for them to whatever reason why they don't want to do advocacy where it's you're talking to people one on one, having conversations. I don't know. Maybe they do want to do that. I don't know. Maybe they do it. Maybe they find it boring, and that's what really makes me sad, because I think that, you know, if we have I do find that when the young vegans come over to my stall and say, when's your next event, and I'm like, this is what we do, and then their faces kind of fall, because they wanted to hear that we were going to paint ourselves in red paint and lie in styrofoam cups, or we were going to hold the corpses of animals in the town square and get video doing it and get our photo in the paper, holding a corpse, you know, looking all dramatic, or go and run around yelling through bullhorns. And so, you know, I might just be it might just be really, really sad reflection on the state of advocacy that it's, yeah. But that to me is quite audacious. And then also this other thing that I saw. So I think they meant well, but my question is that I do feel like, are they avoiding having these, because are they scared that it's going to be confrontational when they actually have a conversation where they're actually, because when you stand in a restaurant and yell, and you get ignored, then you get ignored and that person ignores you. If somebody comes over and starts yelling back at you or starts saying, shut up or get out of my face or whatever like that, that's a possible reaction to what you're doing when you're standing in a restaurant yelling. I don't know, but are they concerned that when they confront people because of what happens online and stuff, that people are going to get really, you know, defensive and abusive and aggressive? Is that why they don't want to do like talk to people? You know, I don't really understand. I don't want to judge. I mean, I've got all kinds of ideas and assumptions as to why people do these things, which I'm not going to go into because, like I said, they're complete strangers. I could say one of the possibilities is that it's a lot less challenging to not have a really detailed conversation and have to deal with all those difficult questions, those tricky questions, because you're not educated yourself. You haven't read any of Gary Francione's books, for example. And so when somebody comes over to you and says something like, I don't know, my daughter has got cancer and animal experimentation saved her life, in my opinion, or something like that, you know, and you have to sort of represent, and there's a chance that you might feel like a failure because you might not be educated enough to actually deal with that question or something. I don't know. So it's just easier to stand on a corner and hold a sign, and then you can feel like you got through to people. You don't really know if you got through to people because you didn't talk to anybody. Yeah. So is it because it's easier? I don't know. Is it because it takes less, you don't have to educate yourself? You don't have to deal with any difficult questions? I don't know. But my dream is that we have a movement of people who are all educated on abolition, who completely refuse to compromise and don't buy into this avoiding focusing on animal rights. I mean, that's literally what they said. They should avoid focusing on the rights of animals. I mean, this is a quote. And then if there are people, and, you know, we can discourage any kind of... you know, but we can't stop people from doing anything, really. I mean, in terms of this kind of stuff, right? I mean, we can't stop people from going out and yelling in restaurants. But I think that if we have an educated movement who is aware of all the questions and is educating themselves on the possibilities, I think that there'll be more people willing to have those conversations with people because you'll feel prepared, and it's satisfying to debunk a lot of myths, and it's satisfying to break through to someone who's set in their mind that, you know, animal use is just the way it is or something, and then you actually say something and you can see them. They've never thought about it before. When I used to first listen to Gary Francione, and I was, you know, he would always say to me, oh, sorry, he wouldn't say it to me. He would always say, you know, whenever he was being interviewed, that people would say to him, I have never thought about it that way before. You know, I've never thought about it, and by it, they mean animal use, that way before. And when he uses the analogies of how, you know, there's, you know, saying that you're going to stop eating meat but keep eating dairy is like saying you're going to eat big cows but you're not going to eat small cows, or whatever like this. You know, the fact that there's absolutely no difference between a dog or animals that they use except for this arbitrary distinction that we as a culture put on them. You know, all of the abolitionist, you know, stuff, the ideas, you know, the profound ideas, people do get impacted by them. So I do wonder about, you know, the sort of temptation of people to do everything but they can possibly do to avoid talking to people. To make a spectacle where you actually don't even give people an opportunity to really talk to you. Like, you almost put up a wall. Like, to me, like, when... I don't know, I'm only in New Zealand, and it's a really different culture than New York, for example, obviously. And so when you, let's say I was standing there with a sign, and I was standing by the side of the road pointing the sign at trucks saying, we see you, we're sorry. And then there's people walking past. I don't think it's really in the nature of many New Zealanders to go up and say, what are you doing? What are you doing? You know, maybe they are, maybe young people, maybe they did get a lot of people saying, what are you doing? What are you doing? I could be wrong, but when you do a very transparent, I am here advocating to you, come and talk to me about your animal use. I want to talk to you about it. I want to challenge you on it. You know, come and talk to me about veganism, which is what we do. I mean, we don't have a sign saying, come and talk to me about your animal use. We say animal rights, veganism, and then a free conversation with. So we're inviting people to come and talk to us. We are clearly wanting people to come over and talk to us. That is the reason we're standing there. And it's very different from sort of not, whether intentionally or not, setting up a barrier to people coming and talking to you. I just do wonder about the motivation. I wonder if that's what it is. If, you know, it's a lot of work to... when I come home from the story stall after a day of dealing with questions, and you still get some questions where you're like... They might come up, like, even just the other, I can't remember which one it was, but I come home at the end of the day and I am wiped out. I'm wiped out mentally and emotionally because I'm having lots of really long, intense conversations. And yes, I'm fielding the same questions over and over, but contrary to popular belief, I do read people and I'm constantly changing tack, watching the reaction to what I've said, seeing if I can take that. Do I need to rephrase it? Do I need to do some damage control? Did they react, you know, did they react to something I just said? And I can see a shift in their eyes. I can see the walls coming down. I need to, you know, and you're really communicating with people on a really deep level about very profound and very violent and difficult things for them to face up to. And then again, questions and objections, and people will do anything to justify animal use, as we know, and you're constantly having to deal with the backyard hen question and the what if I keep the cow and I let the baby drink the milk, and, you know, all of these things, right? And I'm exhausted by the end of the day because of the effort that it takes. I mean, even forget the effort that of just getting up early, making all the cupcakes, although thanks to the lovely Sophie, if I'm organized, I can email her, I can alert her in time, and she will be so kind as to bring cupcakes over, which is so lovely. But even putting aside all the effort of printing and going to the copier, and then all the stapling and all the folding and, you know, setting up the table and carrying all the gear, just the conversations, it's exhausting. In a good way. I mean, this is what I love. I know that I'm reaching people, and that the ideas of reaching people, they're not my ideas. I didn't come up with them. They are just brilliant ideas. And but I do take credit for having read the books and who have and actually done enough advocacy where I can have the conversations and feel quite confident that I'm doing the best I can. And yeah, but it is a lot. It's a lot of work, and I do it for the whole day because I don't get to do it nearly as often as I would like. And because there's not a lot of people who want to do this stuff. Like I said, they'd rather go and yell in a restaurant or stand on a street corner, or they want to wear like a chicken suit and collect money for Safe or whatever. They'll do it for like 2 hours or whatever. I'm there all day because if I'm going to go to all that effort of setting up the thing and making the cupcakes, I'm going to do it for like, I do it for at least 6 hours. And I'm there for six solid hours because I'm not going to go to all that effort just for 2 hours. It's just, I'm going to stay for the whole day. I would love to be able to do it more regularly, you know, but I don't get to do it as often. And that's the only thing I do, because so far I haven't been successful in all the other dreams I've had, which is to have an event where people come and I show them Gary Francione's Theory of Animal Rights video, which is the slideshow, which is mostly words, which for me is one of the most impactful slideshow presentations I've ever seen. When I saw that, it was just mind-blowing to me. This is as a very new vegan, like still
ignorant about what veganism was, still probably doing non-vegan things, not knowing I was doing them, not learning about it till later, things like even silk or wine, you know, was drinking non-vegan wine or whatever, not being careful enough in a restaurant to ask if the veggie burger actually contained eggs, you know, things like that. But when I saw that slideshow, it was just unbelievable, the theory of animal rights slideshow. And I just want more than anything to get a room, even just 10 people, to shut up and watch that slideshow all the way through and read every single slide, because I think it is incredibly impactful. It really, really is. So I haven't had that dream fulfilled of getting abolitionist presentation night together. I saw myself on video where this other person, Claire, her name is, did a presentation, and I was so embarrassed when I saw myself on video that I really don't want to be the one to stand up in front of the... I also have done a YouTube video with the same person where I also was very... I came across really badly. So I don't think we work together well in terms of videos, but the really horrible thing about the video that I saw is I was so nervous that I was I was shaking, my heart was beating, and I was swaying, because when I'm nervous I sway back, like I swing my shoulders back and forth. So I was swinging, and I kept looking at Claire, who was talking, and she was doing a great job. And in fact, I should have just said, when she said, "Do you have anything to say?" I should have just said, "No, you just said it all," because I really just ended up, I don't know, it was so awful. And then, but I was so nervous, I kept looking at her, then looking at the ground, then looking at her, then looking at the ground. And then when I looked at the video afterwards, I could only watch it once, and I'll never watch it again. It looked like I was looking her up and down, like looking at her from head to toe, like, you know, the way they portray in movies where girls look at what other girls are wearing. That's what it looked like, because I was looking at her, looking at the ground, and I was swaying, and I just thought, oh my God, if I ever do a presentation, I just have to have somebody, you know, else to do it, and I just be in the background, because maybe I just wasn't comfortable in that presentation, because it wasn't mine, and it wasn't about Gary Francione's work. I'm very comfortable talking about abolition. So I'll see how I go, but I need, you know, we need other people, we need multiple talents to do this. And I mean, if it comes down to it and there's an event and we can actually get 10 people in a room, I mean, I'd love to say 100, but I'm willing to do the effort for 10 people. To me, that's worth it, to do something right for 10 people rather than do something wrong for 1,000 people and reinforce speciesism for 1,000 people. I think that's damaging. But if it comes down to it and I have to be the presenter and stuff, I'll just have to suck it up, and maybe I'll video myself and I'll try not to sway and I'll try not to look up and down, and you know, I just have to work on those kinds of things. Not my strong point. So I do need more people. We need lots and lots of people, and we don't have them. Everybody wants to go and collect money for SAFE or tell people to cut down or stand on a corner and put up, I don't know, stand around holding a corpse in a town square and get your photo in the paper looking all dramatic. People line up around the block to do that, but will they do a vegan stall? No way. So yeah, so I don't know, maybe I'm just old-fashioned, maybe I don't get it as to why there are so many people willing to do things that I think are really mortifying, like running around in a restaurant screaming, and they don't want to do a educational stall where you're sort of more in control of the situation. It's your space, in a way. You can sort of dictate the pace of things. You have the power to say to somebody, well, I'm not really here to talk about that. Like, I've given people advice before that if you are quite a timid person or you don't feel like you have the courage to deal with hostility, you could have a vegan information stall that's there for people who are interested in veganism. And people who want to argue, you can say, I actually don't want to argue. I really want to just give you information about veganism and answer any questions you have. And I'd really love to help you learn about veganism and go vegan, but I really don't want to argue with you. And I mean, I'm not going to judge you for that at all. Just be consistent, though. Do not compromise the moral message, please. But I even had the other day at the stall last week, or whenever it was, where a guy came over and we started talking, And I was just sitting up, and then he kept saying, well, you know, the typical things. I like meat. And I said, well, you know, I do too. I used to like it as well. In fact, I loved the taste of it. I did not go vegan because I didn't like the taste and blah, blah, blah. And we kept talking, and he could see that he had probably never, like, I'm not saying this to brag. I'm just saying this because this is the reality of the advocacy world we live in. I doubt he'd ever had anybody respond to him in the way that, in the ways that I was responding to him. Because if I was part of what the dominant people were, I would have said to him, well, there are meat-free alternatives. You could try a veggie burger once a week. And he would be like, oh yeah, I can do that. And then we can give each other a high five and yay, job is done, you know. But I just wouldn't back down in terms of I wouldn't let him get away with stuff. But we were having a very amicable conversation. And then he said, well, I have to confess, I'm the son of a butcher. And I said, oh, I mean, don't worry. I said, look, that's got nothing to do with it. I was a customer of butchers. I mean, I said, that's not what this is about. And then he basically said, listen, because he could see that this was, I was there to advocate. I was not going to back down. He said, oh, I don't want to, he said, look, I can see that we're going to argue and I don't want to argue about this because I think you're a very nice person and I just don't want to argue with you. And he just said, so I'm going to go. And I said, okay. And he left. Now to me, that's just, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, you can't force, you know, I still gave him things to think about. I could see him pausing after I was saying things like, well, what's the difference between, you know, these animals, you know, we don't, or just saying things. And he would pause and then you could see it making an impact. So I don't know what he's going to do afterwards, but he certainly got some new ideas to think about. I certainly didn't reinforce any speciesist ideas. And I would like to think that he will actually be more open to considering having a vegan burger after meeting me than he would if he had met someone who said just, you know, cut down, have your meat 3 times a week instead of 5 or whatever. I mean, this is all conjecture. I don't claim to have statistics, but I do know that as a movement, we have to challenge the paradigm and change it. And it does take time. And we know this. And also, I do know that in the last 5 years that I've observed, there is actually changes happening and more people are actually going vegan. And I don't think it's any coincidence that it started after the abolitionist movement kind of got going. I'm noticing a difference in my own city. I'm noticing a difference in the vegans in my own city, even dedicated welfarers who are confusing things and everything like that. But they're never saying the things that they used to say before, although some are pretty blatant. Like this article is shocking. I'll just read the last line again. They should avoid focusing on the rights of animals or how one needs to be vegan to have moral consistency. That's animal advocates who wish to create the most diet change and thereby spare the most animals. This is what their claim is. I'll leave it up to you to, you know, read the data, but I hope that I at least maybe broke through a little bit, you know. Just think about it. Really think about what these people are doing and what their agenda possibly is. But no, I shouldn't. Their agenda, according to them, is to reduce suffering. They really seem to believe that they're going to reduce suffering by avoiding focusing on the rights of animals. And it really makes me so sad. They are missing the trees, forest for the trees, or whatever the case is. And they're actually letting slip through their fingers a chance to be part of a real paradigm shift. And they're leaving it up, you know, they're refusing to do it. So they're still reinforcing the status quo of speciesism. So they're perpetuating the cycle, and then they point to the statistics and say, well, people are much more amenable to our message, according to our statistics, than they are to your message. And I haven't even gone into the human rights analogies, right? Like, if you take the world of patriarchy and you say to men, you know, just objectify women a little bit less, or just objectify them kindly, or, I mean, that's going to be way more amenable to a patriarchal world that benefits from objectifying women than saying to them, stop objectifying women, because it's wrong. But the feminist movement, I mean, the radical feminist movement, understands the, you know, what we need to do to make change. So they don't agree with kowtowing to patriarchy, and rightly so. But you don't see any studies about any humane rape campaigning, because nobody would ever put up with that. But when it comes to non-humans, these people can get a lot of play and endorsement from all of the leaders of the movement. So yeah, okay, well, how long was that? An hour. I hope it had some kind of cohesion and some kind of sense. More than anything, I hope it inspires anybody listening to go out and do some creative, nonviolent, vegan education. Educate yourself first so that you can have these challenging conversations. It's very satisfying to be able to have a conversation with someone in which you are prepared and you are confident in the ideas and the refutations of the objections. You are able to advocate for non-humans' animal rights. Don't you want to advocate for their rights? Don't you? Isn't that much more satisfying than avoiding even mentioning their rights? Come on. Look into your heart. That's all I'll say. All right. Thank you very much for listening. And I'm going to say I'll be back. And ka kite. Ka kite is Māori for see you, and ka kite anō is see you again.